Welcome to Inspirational Tales. When my guests on this podcast experience the most challenging times of their lives, they use these hardships to learn, grow, and better themselves. And as a result, they are now thriving in life. Their stories are ones of resilience, strength, and overcoming adversity. So sit back and join me as we celebrate them turning their challenges into triumphs. My guest on this episode is Crystal Barter. Crystal has an extensive family history of breast cancer and grew up watching the women in her family being diagnosed and unfortunately getting very sick and passing away. After years of believing that their family was cursed, Crystal's mum and nan were two of the first women in Australia to be tested and find out that they had the BRCA gene mutation. In her early 20s, Crystal also found out that she had this gene mutation, but unlike the generations before her, this knowledge gave Crystal preventative options and she eventually decided to have a double mastectomy. It was while she was recovering from her surgery that Crystal founded Pink Hope, a preventative breast cancer organization that has gone on to help thousands of women by providing them with the education and support that was not available to Crystal when she was going through her testing and surgery. In this interview, Crystal openly discusses how watching her loved ones go through breast cancer affected her and how she navigated her preventative options during a time when breast cancer was not widely discussed. She explains why she allowed her surgery to be featured on the TV show 60 Minutes, why she founded Pink Hope, and how it led her to meeting Angelina Jolie. Crystal has helped so many people through her work, and I thank her for being so open and honest in sharing her story with all of us today. Hi, Crystal. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure.
So today we are going to speak about your story and a topic that I feel like pretty much everyone has an experience with, which is breast cancer. So whether it be that they've had it themselves or they know someone, a family friend, or you know someone else they know has had it, I feel like pretty much everyone could benefit from hearing you speak about your story today. So thank you very much. I would like to start off with, like I do with all of my interviews, though, back at the very beginning. So if we could go back to your childhood, your early childhood, so say before your mum was diagnosed with cancer, and can you give us a bit of a rundown of kind of what your childhood was like, what you were like and what your family unit was like back then?
Goodness, that's going back. Yeah, look, I definitely struggled as like a young person and a teenager, I would say significantly my whole life in terms of different levels of social anxiety and not feeling comfortable in my own skin. And I never really could pinpoint those concerns. It was just, I guess, in me from a really young age. And I guess, you know, when I started developing my own breasts and my own body and knew from a really young age that breast cancer was such a significant part of my life, you know, I had my nan who had concave chest and prosthesis, and I didn't really see many other women in my family. It was really, you know, either sick or disfigured. And that's, I can remember that from, you know, being really young. I used to think it was funny playing with my nan's prosthesis when I was in the bath, and like I'd call myself Dolly Parton and run around, and I just didn't understand the significance of it. But yet, when I was about 14 and started kind of developing my own, you know, anxieties and a bit of depression and things like that, my mum was diagnosed with cancer, and I was like a really selfish teenager for sure, as I'm sure most teenagers would relate to. And I just didn't cope at all. And even though my mum's cancer was diagnosed earlier, it was the process of everything she had to go through, and she didn't cope very well with the significant surgeries that she had, and she had a lot of other conflicting health conditions that made the recovery difficult. And so I didn't really cope at all with that. And I think, you know, at a certain level, the trauma in a way definitely shaped my response to how I coped as a teenager. You know, I turned to drugs and alcohol, and that's not to say that my mum's cancer was to blame. I was probably on that path anyway and really just didn't know who I was. And it's funny you ask that question, because I was literally washing the front deck this morning and was thinking about that, was thinking about, you know, I guess the shame of how I coped, who I was growing up.
Why do you say the shame?
I don't know. I just never think I responded to things in the way that I could have. But yet at the same time, I was finding myself under this, you know, dark cloud of cancer. Like, I didn't know anything else in my life.
Yep.
I guess I felt like my future was so firmly mapped out for me, even before I knew that the cancer was because of a gene mutation. It was like, they called it, you know, the Codlin curse, which was my great grandmother's family. They called it, you know, the death lottery. Like, we were from a small country town in New Zealand. My mum's side of the family was like, everyone got cancer in my mum's side of the family. And, you know, my nan had it three times and she died the third time.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, but cancer's not rare. Like, it's you'll always meet someone that's faced cancer at some point in your life. So I know it's not rare and my story is not unique in that way, but I guess I just didn't cope with it. And now, kind of having my own children and having the gift of maturity and healing and time, I've been able to address those kind of demons that I faced when I was younger, for sure.
Do you know how far back the cancer goes in your family?
Yeah, as far back as I can remember. So obviously my nan, my great-grandma, and then she came from a quite large family, I believe. I think there was 9 children. So her mum or dad's side. So it's come. It has to come from somewhere. And we came from Prussia, so we've got Jewish ancestry.
Okay.
So predominantly that's the BRCA gene mutation has high prevalency rates in the Jewish community.
So you're now talking about the BRCA gene, which you now know runs in your family, but back then didn't know. When were you able to find out, and when did the genetic testing actually come in so that your mum and your grandma were actually able to find out that they were carriers of this gene?
So I can remember, I guess, the moment. It was over 20 years ago, right? So quite a long time ago. Might have been closer to 25. My nan was in the hospital with her brother who was having an issue. I think there was a bowel cancer, early bowel cancer or some kind of issue. And she met a geneticist. Her name was Ingrid Winship, Professor Ingrid Winship. She's highly regarded, amazing lady. And my nan just said to her, help us. And she linked us with a research consortium called KCOMFAB. That's based out of Peter MacCallum in Melbourne, and we were one of the first families tested for BRCA in Australia. So my mum and nan were tested first, and I was offered it when I was 18, but I wasn't ready. Like, I was a mess at 18 that I wasn't ready for that kind of information. So it wasn't until I had my firstborn. But it came back, you know, my mum and nan were both positive for the BRCA gene mutation, so that your listeners understand what a BRCA mutation is. Like, everyone has BRCA1 and 2 genes. Generally, they protect you from cancer, but I've got a fault in one of mine. So when your DNA kind of, you know, repairs itself and regenerates, mine has a fault. So it puts me kind of at risk of cancer. So it's just a spelling mistake in, what did my geneticist said? She said it's a spelling mistake, one spelling mistake in the yellow pages.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So your mum and your nan came back positive for the genetic mutation. But being relatively new, you're saying, in Australia at the time, what was the kind of education around that? What could they do with that knowledge?
Well, they'd already had cancer, right? So they couldn't really do much with it other than try and prevent other forms of cancer occurring that they were at risk for, and trying ever so hard to convince their renegade, crazy 18-year-old granddaughter and daughter that this was really important information. And I just buried my head in the sand at 18. No one wants to know that they're potentially going to die of a cancer that's eradicated your whole family and left them scarred. So for me, it was kind of just waiting until I was ready and forgetting about it as much as I could. And it wasn't until I fell pregnant, met an amazing man who we're still married today. He kind of made me find myself in a way. He's so centered and so caring and so considerate. And we had a beautiful little son together who's now nearly 17. And it wasn't until I held him in my arms that I knew that I had to do something. And he was the inspiration behind getting the test. I went in, it was a simple blood test, and I waited 6 weeks and got the results.
So how old were you at the time?
I was 20, just after 21, so 21, 22, yeah.
Now, in terms of as well, the women in your family who have had cancer, they had it young, didn't they?
Yeah, so my mum was 36, my nan was 44, 53 and early 70s, so she had breast and then tongue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was horrible. I would not wish that on my worst enemy. That was just terrific. And my great-grandma was 68, so it's come down younger and younger every generation. No rhyme or reason, just is.
So what was the chance that you were going to be positive for the mutation?
50-50. So everyone who has this gene mutation has a 50-50 chance of inheriting it. So it's like flipping a coin. So you can inherit the BRCA gene mutation from either your mother or your father. So it's weird to say that you can inherit a risk of ovarian cancer through your dad. And it's something that a lot of people don't understand, but you get your genes. You are 50% your mum and 50% your dad. Mm-hmm. That, I think, when it comes to family history, is something that a lot of people don't think about. I inherited it from my mum's. We're kind of this poster child, easy to spot traditional breast cancer, some ovarian cancer family, but for a lot of families, that picture may not be clear. So I think it's really important to understand that.
So when you found out that you had the mutation, what were your options that you were given? So you've been told you've got this mutation, everyone in your family is getting cancer. What do you do with that information?
Well, my geneticist handed me the piece of paper and she said, your outcomes will be completely different to that of your mum's. And I'll never forget it. And I said, how? Tell me how. And she said, you actually, you know, you've got screening, which you can do, you know, in your 30s. You can have chemo prevention, which was oral tablets that could reduce my risk, preventative surgery. I had some options placed, but she said, you know, you need to go home. You need to think about it. And I'm an overthinker. I always have been. I overthink everything. So I went home and I went on Google. And back then, there wasn't a lot of information around this. It was very new. So it was like going down this dark web of, you know, where do I get this information? How does this relate to me? Is there anyone else who has this out there? So I kind of started making those connections very early on, and I connected with a couple of women in the US, Lindsay Hafner and Sue Friedman, who founded organizations over there, and they were really pivotal, really supportive to kind of the process and my thinking and getting me the information that I needed.
So you've got your son now, you've got a positive test result, all this information that you've been given about what you can do. What did you decide to do first?
I definitely didn't want to do anything too rash, too quickly. So we got married. We had another baby, just kind of enjoyed as much as we could living in the moment. But little did I know that I was suffering from really, really bad insomnia and anxiety. It was just, you know, all of a sudden, like, I'd go dizzy and I couldn't breathe. And I was like, oh God, I've got lung cancer. Oh God, I've got this, I've got that. Yeah. So I had a lot of health anxiety. And it wasn't until I went, you know, I had my firstborn, had my second, and then I kind of just wasn't coping with the information. I wasn't sleeping at night. I really struggled during the pregnancy as well. Like, I ended up in hospital because I bled when it was 6 months along. And so it was just challenging. And it wasn't until after I'd had him, I went to my therapist and I told her, like, I'm really, really struggling with all of this weight. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll just have another baby and it'll get better. And then she goes, do you think, you know, you're just band-aiding the problem to try and, you know, forget about it? I said, yeah, I am. I'm going to go book in to have my preventative surgery, because I felt like just this huge cloud. Like, I didn't have cancer and I felt this huge guilt as well. So I kind of hid a lot of what I was feeling from my mom and my family, because I felt like I didn't have cancer, so I didn't deserve to have these feelings. I'm being dramatic. I'm being overly anxious. Like, how ridiculous. I went in for my last mammogram and I proudly said to the mammography radiologist, I'm getting my breast removed, so I won't be in here again. And she said, okay, that's great. We'll take some pictures. And then she came back and I said, well, we've just got to take a few more. And oops, we've got to take a few more. And I knew my heart sunk. I was like, oh my God, what's wrong? And she was like, nothing's wrong. We're just going to send you up to see the specialist. And I went up and they said, we found linear lines of calcification in your breast tissue. And for someone who's been scared of this their whole life, to be kind of told that in just a moment, I was like, oh, take them. I don't care if it's nothing, just take them. I never want to see them again. You know, they've been this, like this tiny little B cup that I had that was saggy after breastfeeding, became like this huge, they were like lead weights. They'd just been dragging me through my whole life that I just said, take them. Like I never want to see my breasts again, get rid of them. And so 2 weeks later, I had my breasts removed.
What's the chance, if you do have the mutation, what's the chance that you will get cancer?
It's really personal. It's really hard to quantify. I think, you know, there is everything from 78 to 64% to 78 to 84%. But it's really hard for me to quantify that because it's a discussion that has to happen with a genetic counselor and a geneticist to really understand what your own personal risk is. But for me, there was no one in my family who had this gene mutation that didn't develop breast or ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't one person, like it wasn't as if I could hold on to hope that it wasn't going to happen. There was none of that in my family. So, and to kind of sum up, from getting this BRCA gene test to having my breast removed, like it was years, right? In between that, it was a few years. So I was 25 when I had my preventative mastectomy, you know, 21, 22 when I got my BRCA gene test results. And in that time, like I was having to advocate for myself at every key touch point, from, you know, lobbying to get onto an early screening program because they weren't going to screen me until I was in like 35 and I wasn't comfortable with that. I wasn't coping, you know, trying to find the information, trying to connect with other people like me. Like it was a huge task that I felt like I was largely navigating alone.
No wonder you had anxiety.
Yeah,
mental health issues.
I did growing up anyway, like, yeah. And it just compounded with processing that information largely alone. I have a great family. I have an amazing husband. I know that I'm incredibly fortunate there, but for me, I felt the weight of the world every day. It was hard to breathe.
Wow, I can't imagine what that must be like. It must be horrible. So you decide to have your breasts removed, and 60 Minutes actually covered this and your story. How did that come about, and why did you decide to do it so publicly and have cameras following you in hospital in such a massive experience like that for you?
Yeah, look, I just felt, you know, my mum had done a lot. Like she had spent her whole life volunteering for the National Breast Cancer Foundation, raising money, sharing her story. You know, she spoke with John Howard and Jeanette Howard at the Opera House. Like she was my inspiration. Like she'd spent her whole life trying to help people. She is like the kindest person you'll ever meet. Like she has palliative cared so many of her friends that have died of cancer. Like she's just an angel. And for me, it was very much just wanting to do something that removed it from just being about me. I wanted to help other people and I wanted to do something with my story. And I don't know why. Like, honestly, why does anyone do anything like that? Because it wasn't the easiest process. Like, it was pretty raw. My boobs were on national television. Like, it wasn't as if it was something, you know, you didn't get paid for it. Like, you're doing it because there isn't something else driving it. But the best thing that came out of it is one of my best friends, Stacey Gadd, who was featured on 60 Minutes. Her and I speak like all the time. She's just the most remarkable person. We've been friends since that day. She became like, you know, a shoulder for me to lean on and vice versa through everything that's happened between now and then. So, you know, there's been great things that have come out of, you know, me sharing my story for sure.
How did it come about? Like, how did they approach you? How did they even know about you?
I can't even remember, to be honest. One of the producers there, I think we connected. And I'd been on the Today Show a few times before that, I think, with Sarah Murdoch for the National Breast Cancer Foundation. Like, it just happened. Mm-hmm. My family had done a lot of advocacy work before that, not as publicly, but we'd done a lot as a family, raising funds and helping to raise the profile of breast cancer for a long time. My mum and my nan had.
And just to give us an idea, because obviously now in this, well, this is coming out in 2022. I had to think about that. Breast cancer is quite widely shown in the media and everything now. Mm-hmm. But back then, what was it like?
I can remember, you know, being so embarrassed when I was like 14, telling people that my mum had breast cancer. Like,
it embarrassed?
It was embarrassing. Like, boobs were not talked about. They were not, you know, it was really, you know, it wasn't something to talk about. The way that it is, the way that we talk about it now, is so different to how it was for so many women before us. And there wasn't the funding, and there wasn't the high survival rates, and there wasn't what we've got today. But still, you know, when you think about breast cancer, I know so much about it now. I feel like I'm like a patient, a practitioner, because I feel like, you know, I have so many people coming to me, talking, telling me about their experiences from all across the world. So I still kind of do a lot of work in that space. So I hear patients all across the world. And I think as widely recognized as breast cancer is, there is still a lot of women suffering from it and a lot of women dying from it. And so, yeah, I think we can sometimes gloss over that for sure.
So you had the double mastectomy. How did you feel once that had happened?
Yeah, it was a weird feeling. It was definitely painful, I'm not going to lie. Like, there was a few days where it was really uncomfortable. And I had a 9-month-old and I think it was 4 at the time. So I had little kids who just wanted to hug their mum. Mm. And to not be able to hug them the way that I normally would, that was tough. But I felt like free. I said to mum, like, I feel like for once in my life I can dream of growing old.
Oh.
Yeah, I think, you know, for my whole life I never really imagined myself old. It was weird. Yeah.
No, it's not weird when you've got a family history like that.
Yeah.
But it must have been a huge burden to carry. And then did it just feel like it was lifted?
Yeah, in a way, like, I think to not take away from the gravity of kind of what I've gone through since then, that it just felt like a just peace of mind. Just felt, yeah, that, you know, I always say those small B-cup boobs were definitely weighing me down more than I thought they were. So I felt just lighter in more ways than one.
So while you're recovering from your surgery, you have the idea to start what would become Pink Hope. Can you explain, firstly, what Pink Hope is and why you decided to do that while you were recovering from your surgery?
Yeah, I felt really, really alone. You know, obviously I had Stacey from 60 Minutes and I had, you know, people over in the US, but that was really it for me. I was like talking to organizations that were like, well, when you get cancer or if you get cancer, we can help you. And to me, I was like, it's just so lonely. It's so lonely for people who have this gene mutation or have a risk of cancer and want to do something about it. And it just started as a forum, honestly, to help people and to connect people. And it just grew and grew and grew. But it was like creating a not-for-profit, like, it's the hardest job I've ever had.
Why do you say
that? It's all day and all night. Like, I had to build, you know, websites, like, entering in all the information. I had to respond to all of these people coming through. And there was hundreds all the time, hundreds. And I would be on the phone all day and all night, you know, advocating for the needs of patients, you know, having to tick all of the boxes associated with a not-for-profit. Like, it's not glitzy, running a not-for-profit. Like, the glitz and the glamour is probably 3% of the time. It's hard work. And getting funding and fundraising, it was a lot.
And was it just you doing all of this?
Yeah, initially, because there wasn't any funding to be able to kind of hire anyone. It was at least 4 years in before I could do that. So I had amazing, you know, I had my family and I had volunteers off and on helping. So it was never just me. But at the same time, when everyone would go home and turn off their lights, I would be working. Nothing is ever created by just one person, so I never want to give that illusion. But creating not-for-profits is hard work, and I applaud anyone who manages to do it, because it was not easy.
And what exactly does Pink Hope do?
Yeah, so now it's I'm not involved in it operationally day to day. I stepped down like 2 and a bit years ago, which is amazing.
And why did you do that?
I just needed to do something else. I needed to be able to be someone else and needed to be able to, I guess, in a way, do more, which is weird to say. But for me, I'd given so much of my family, my life to Pink Hope that I felt like I deserved to have a little break from it. But it's a preventative health organisation. Like when I left it, you know, we had an online genetic counsellors, information support days. We'd advocated for some huge wins, lowered the price of genetic testing, helped to get BRCA testing on Medicare, discussed the issues around breast density, connected thousands of patients around the country with each other. So it was pretty remarkable that a little organization that people would sometimes call and go, can I speak to your marketing manager or this or that? And I'm like laughing, going, oh my God, like there's a tiny team. But, you know, I definitely think it's done some amazing work and had some great people working in it at times. And yeah, it's just on a different path now for sure.
It's incredible. You should be so proud of yourself for starting that and continuing, and with everything that you were going through at the time as well. It's not like you were well and...
No, I've like, to be honest, I've probably had more surgeries since that mastectomy than I ever thought I would have. Like I had a prolapse 4 years ago, I think. I had adenomyosis, which dragged all of my organs out. I had to have massive reconstruction there. I had ovary, fallopian tubes out. Like, it's not been pretty. My body's a bit of a lemon. My husband and I laugh. My mind's not. I think my mind's...
Well, that's good.
You know, yeah, it's good for the moment. But yeah, my body's a bit of a lemon. So I definitely would have traded her in long ago if I could have. But, you know, cloning's not an option.
So how have you coped with all of this happening? After thinking, you know, you've had your double mastectomy, I'm presuming at the time you probably thought that was it for the time being.
I had 7 surgeries since that mastectomy, just on my chest.
Why? Can I ask?
So the first lot of implants weren't right. They didn't sit right, so I had to have them. Then I got another lot of implants and then they ruptured. And then I responded to my most recent implants very poorly. So I had hair falling out, headaches 24/7. So I had an immune response to my last implants that made me very sick. So I'm literally completely flat now. So when I talk about, you know, concave chest, what my grandma had, like that's what I've got. And that's been really hard for me to process as a woman, to end up here after it all. But, you know, I'm grateful for every day. Like I've got the most amazing children, husband, and I just want to live as long as I can. Whatever I need to do that, I'll do.
Yeah, definitely. This issue with breast implants is one that seems to be coming out a bit more lately as well. Not just in obviously the breast cancer community, but in general that people can get sick from them.
Yeah.
Which hasn't been widely spoken about, I don't think.
No.
Very much before then.
No, and I've not really told my story at all in regards to that, because I'm really passionate about ensuring that women have the right to choose and have reconstruction and have access to it if they want, and that we don't talk about it so much that it stops women from potentially preventing breast cancer, by not going and having preventative mastectomies. Like, I don't want to have that happen. But yeah, I was really, really sick with my last lot of implants. They made me very, very ill. I have an autoimmune disease. I have Hashimoto's, which, once again, inherited from my family.
And for anyone that doesn't know, that's a thyroid.
Yeah, thyroid condition. So I medicated off for that, but I had to get rid of them. They were making me really sick. And to be honest, I feel much better since getting rid of them in terms of the flare-ups with my Hashimoto's and my hair. Like, it's grown. It's like long and thick. And I used to have like just, it was like gone. So I feel really fortunate that, you know, I advocated for myself and figured it out.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And so in amongst all this and Pink Hope, you actually met Angelina Jolie. Can you explain how that came about?
That's the one question that is always guaranteed to be asked.
Okay, I won't ask it. It's all right. Don't answer.
No, go. No, I love it. It's funny.
So she came out and spoke quite openly about having the BRCA gene, and which then brought it into the world media, basically. How did you come about meeting her?
She did more for the BRCA gene in one article than, you know, decades of work, right? Like, she put it on a platform that changed everything. So I can remember when she came out, I was actually picking up my son from school, and the Today Show called and said, "Crystal, we need you on the Today Show." And I said, "Okay, but why?" "Angelina has your gene mutation." I was like, "What? Why?" I was like gifted the Angelina Jolie gene, as we now refer to it. But, you know, in that 3 days, I think I did like 400, 500, God knows how many interviews. I was like on CNN. I was beamed across the world. The organization that, you know, was really struggling in terms of funding, you know, grew by 700%. Like, in only a few days, like, it was nuts. Now social media channels blew up, like, it was incredible. And I can remember having the most amazing volunteers. Like, I just called all of them to my house, and it was like, we had this mini press conference. We had like 7, 9, 10 SBS, ABC out the front of our house. And it was so funny, like, had these patients, incredible patients, sharing their stories from my living room and the bedroom and the backyard. I think it was like our own little press office for a few days. It was remarkable. And, you know, my mom and my nan, everyone helped, like, everyone banded in, and really kind of, it was an opportunity to share those stories and to share the cause and the mission. And yeah, I was incredibly grateful. And then obviously got a really random call saying that Angelina wanted to invite me to her film premiere. I think it was a year or a bit later. And I thought it was a prank call. That was pretty funny. And then, yeah, they sent me the invite, sent a car to pick me up, and took me to the premiere, and I got to hug Angelina and Brad.
And I'm Brad too.
A photo of Angelina and I were taken when we hugged, and that went everywhere, and that was amazing. But, yeah, the hug with Brad after that was, the icing on the cake.
So how did it feel to have now your organization being so out there, so much more funding, so much more, I don't know, everything just out there more all of a sudden, like, not even gradually?
Yeah, it was pretty full on, because I think it created more work, right? Mm-hmm. But it enabled us to get another one or two people to work in the team. So it was an incredible time, like, and the work that we got to do and the people that we got to help was amazing.
Do you think that was the catalyst for then the media showing more interest?
Yeah.
Because, like, now I know there's obviously, like, you know, not that long ago, the Bold type had a whole storyline about one of the characters having the BRCA gene mutation, and I'm sure there's been lots of other ones.
Yeah, Home and Away even did it, like.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's, there's a lot more out there now compared to what you were saying about when, you know, back when you were...
I had no one. Yeah. Like, it was really tough. There was no stories that I could look at. There was no TV shows that were talking about it. And it's I'm so proud to see that that narrative is now different. And that is not, like, I can't take any of the credit for that. Like, I definitely did some groundwork, but there's so many amazing people in this space now, from researchers and scientists to other patients to people sharing their stories on Instagram. And I kind of sit back and I watch it all now and I'm like, you know, it was definitely the right time for me to tap out, because I felt like so much great stuff is happening. If patients need to see a story, if they need to hear something, if they need to not feel alone, it's there.
But you were originally doing it, so I don't think you can say you can take no credit. You said you can take no credit. I don't think that's true. Definitely some. Definitely. I mean, you created a whole organization that helps women with this. I mean, not many people would do that and follow through. And I'm sure you've helped. Do you know how many people? Is there a ballpark how many people you've helped?
I would say it'd be thousands.
Yeah, so I don't think you can downplay it that much.
I definitely know that my phone bill would say it's thousands. It was a lot.
So you have three children now.
Yeah.
How do you go about talking to them and educating them, especially your older one? You said, 17? So it's not like they're a little baby. How do you go about talking to them about this and your family history and everything?
It's really challenging because I don't think I'll ever get it perfect. I've just been as open as I can with them and allowed them to ask the questions whenever they need to. But I'm also hugely hyper aware that I just want them to feel like kids for as long as they can. I want them to just live their life as much as they can before they have to kind of do adulting, because adulting's a lot. Yeah. So for me, I've brought them, you know, to events, so they've seen me talk, they know my story, they know what our family is. But, you know, I dropped my daughter to the mall just before and she's going for a swim, and, you know, and my son's going out to a party tonight, and I'm just like, they're just living their life, and that is what I want for them as much as humanly possible before we have to kind of sit down and go, okay, when do you want this testing? I don't want to have that conversation with them until they're a little bit older.
How old do you have to be to actually have the test done?
18.
18, okay.
Yeah. But every family is different, and what I'm doing or what someone else is doing is not going to be right for everyone. Mm. So I think if you don't feel confident to have those conversations, or you're not sure, like, chat to others and maybe you'll find what would work for you. Because, yeah, I'm just trying to err on the side of caution by being as open and transparent as possible with that, but without scaring the crap out of them.
Yeah. Well, because obviously you know what it's like as well, what you went through when you were a child or a teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not easy.
It wasn't easy. And, you know, I struggled in general with social anxiety and identity issues and lots of different things. So I think that, yeah, I understand it probably more than others would. Mm-hmm.
What would you say to someone who has just found out that they have the BRCA gene? What advice would you give to them?
For me, it's about not delving too deep into Google. Like, I literally spent all day and all night trying to get as much information as I could, but there wasn't any kind of really strong evidence-based information out there. It was like looking for a needle in a haystack. It's different now. So I think figuring out the information that they want and the kind of support that they want, and whether it's just getting it on social media and connecting with others, or whether it's, you know, peer-to-peer, or they need therapy, or whatever it is, it's got to be right for you. But don't think that you can largely do it alone, because you will need to talk to someone, whether it's an expert, whether it's, you know, getting counselling or chatting to someone who's been through it. I think that can't be underestimated as a really powerful tool.
So since you've moved on from being that involved in Pink Hope. You've gone on and founded another organisation called Humanize Health. Can you explain what the work that you're doing with that is?
Oh my goodness, I know. I'm a sucker for punishment, aren't I? I know. I just kind of like, I'm not a half in, half out kind of person with Pink Hope. I never could be half there. I was either all in or all out. And for me, I wanted to do something that was kind of healthcare more broadly. So looking at other areas of health that I haven't really considered, and learning and evolving my thinking there. So I created a Humanize Health, which is like we make health personal. And predominantly it is, we co-create initiatives, projects, content alongside patients for a lot of different clients. And, you know, we're working on one project at the moment, which is taking us around the world, like virtually, obviously, talking to patients across Russia, across Brazil, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Australia, everywhere, and listening to their stories and seeing their experiences and the challenges that they're facing. And oh my God, like I've cried, I've laughed, I have learnt to say that I'm continuing to live like a purposeful career is an understatement. I'm getting to listen in such a privileged way to people's lived experience, and to figure out the challenges and the pain points that they face and try and do something about it, which for me is something I've always wanted to do. But I love kind of being behind the scenes now. It's not necessarily me sharing my story. I'm like an amplifier of others. So the types of projects that we work on are anything from advocacy campaigns to patient-led content initiatives to managing projects and bringing all the right people on board. And we've been booked out ever since. Like, we started 2 years ago, which is ridiculous. And I pinch myself every day. I've got the best clients that actually are genuinely good human beings. That's like my thing. I'll only work with great people that want to do the right thing by kind of patients and consumers alike. And I'm loving it.
It's fantastic.
Every day it doesn't feel like work. And my husband always like gets so jealous because I'm like, okay, I'm off to work. And I work from home, which is fine. But I'm like always so happy about it. And to me, I've never really had an easy life in terms of health and lots of different issues. That work for me has always been a way for me to do something positive. And it's been a real vehicle for change within me. Like, I've become a totally different person through, you know, listening to people's stories and throughout my whole career and growing as a person. It's really shaped me, which I'm thankful for, not the other way around. I'm really thankful for the opportunity to do what I do.
What do you hope for your future then?
I just want to live to a point where my kids are okay. That was always the thing for me. I'm like, I want to get my kids married or not married or whatever they want. I just want them to feel like they can do it on their own. And I think that's just a mother's thing. I don't think that's unique to me. I think that's what mothers want in general, or parents want in general. I just want to live long enough to get them okay. That in my heart is what I want. And then, you know, you can layer that with, I want to go on holidays and I want to do all these things, which in all honesty, great, that'll make my life better, but it's not important. What's important is looking after my health as best as I can, fighting for answers if things don't feel right, and looking after my kids and my husband and having a career that I love. And I've got so far in this moment all of these things. Tomorrow is a different story, but right now I feel very fortunate that I have those things.
That's incredible. And you're so humble. I think you as well. You need to take a bit more credit for yourself.
Maybe I did when I was younger, when I was for sure like, but now it's not about that for me. It never really was. You know, I've definitely seen the best and the worst in things in the not-for-profit space. Like, I had horrible emails sent to me about, you know, you do it for the applause and not the cause, and met people that didn't have the best intentions, and it kind of just cemented what I can cope with as a human being and what I want in my life. And I just want good people, and I just want my husband and my family and my kids. And COVID's kind of shifted everything, right? Like, mm-hmm. we know what's important in life now. And for me, it's just resonated even deeper with me. So I think, yeah, it's like learning and evolving and changing as a human being, I think, is what we have to do. If we stay the same, we die, right? Mm-hmm. So I've definitely grown in the last few years, in the last few decades, to be honest. It's been a wild ride, I'm not going to lie. I don't think you can capture it in an hour, that's for sure. But, yeah, it's that whole thing. I come alive. Whenever anyone asks me how my day is going, I'm like, I'm breathing, it's a good day. Mm-hmm. And that's really in my family what it's about. Like, if we wake up and we're living our life, and I'm always in pain, like there's always something going on in my body that stresses me out because I have a lot of health anxiety, obviously. But for me, it's just doing the best that I can by my husband, my kids and my family. And
you.
And me. Oh, I'm always last on that list. Don't worry.
Don't forget that.
No, I can't. It's like, really, come on. The moment I signed up to being a parent, that's what happens. But you know what? Like, I've taken a couple of days off work just doing a few things here and there. And I'm not a very good housewife. And my house is clean and the washing is done. And I feel like this sense of like accomplishment that I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, I'm not very good at those things. I never really have been. I've definitely been more of a worker, and, you know, I'm a good mum. I know that I'm a good mum. But I've never been good at those things. So, you know, I had dinner on the table for my husband last night. He was like, what? Is this an ulterior universe? Like, alternate universe? I was like, okay. Maybe I need to do that more. 2022 resolution.
So I have one final question that I ask everyone at the end of their interviews. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
There's so much pieces of advice that young girl needed. It would be just try and be yourself as much as you can be, and it's going to be okay. That was really, a sense of doom was always there in my family, understandably. Like my mom, everything she'd been through in her life, and I think that there was this bit of trauma that we had to unpack that we have only really started to do in the last few years. Yeah.
How is your mum now?
She's had like 30 different surgeries.
Oh my goodness.
She's never been 100% well my whole life. And she's just the most remarkable woman. Like, she gives so much to so many people. Like, I've got a son who has, you know, really quite bad social anxiety, and, you know, they bought a farm to help look after him. And, aww. You know, I've got the most amazing family that I feel like that's all that I need in life, right? Mm-hmm. Is to have good family and reasonable health, and I'll be fine. And I feel like I've got those things, which I know how lucky that is.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. So lovely to hear it and speak with you.
Thank you so much. You ask great questions.
Oh, thank you.
Got me thinking. I'm going to have a wine tonight and decompress them all.
Oh, no, I've made you go out and drink. That's not a good sign, is it?
No, I rarely drink, but, you know, a glass of wine here and there is something that I think, you know, alleviates a little bit of stress, right?
Yeah, well, I can't imagine what you've been through and the trauma, like you said, the trauma of everything.
Yeah, but I know it's always that thing. It's always that thing of I've always told myself there's always someone worse off than what you're going through. And it's so true because I speak to them all the time. Like, to me, I know that what I've gone through is a blimp or drop in the ocean for so many other people. But then at the same time, I go, it's really important to validate our feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't think I ever really did that. I have always hidden a lot of my feelings. And it's only recently that I've got better at it. And I think it's just growing, getting old, getting older.
Getting more mature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. So
well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for the chat, the therapy session. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspirational Tales. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you could please share it with your family and friends so that we can inspire more people. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please don't forget to leave us a rating or a review, and make sure that you have subscribed or followed the podcast on whichever platform that you are listening to it on so that you can stay up to date as new episodes are released. Thanks again, and I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Inspirational Tales.